dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing in the war for the free world. I'm very pleased to say that in the course of my time doing this program, I've come to know a man who has both considerable intelligence and a lot of firsthand experience, both in the uniform of the United States Marine Corps and as a civilian. In one of the perhaps most important and yet least recognized battlefronts in that war for the free world, he has actually served as a Marine in Latin America, and so has a firsthand understanding of its complexities and dynamics, and has spent his post-military service time, notably as the executive director of the Center for a Secure, Free Society, helping the rest of us understand what's at stake there and what we had best do about it. He co-edited a very important book addressing a subject in which we are going to be delving deeply today, namely foreign interventions in Latin America, very much contrary to the spirit of the Monroe Doctrine, enunciated centuries ago now. The book is entitled Iran's Strategic Penetration of Latin America, and we will be talking about what the Iranians are up to, as well as some of their friends, to, I believe, very strongly the detriment of the people of Latin America, as well as our own vital interests there. His name is Joseph Heumeier. He's a friend and much admired colleague, and we're always delighted to have him with us, especially when we get a chance to talk with him at length, which we're going to do today for this full hour of a very special and, I hope, very informative conversation about Latin America and what is happening there that is of real concern to the United States and its people. Joseph Heumeier, it's so good to talk with you. Thank you for both joining us and for giving so generously of your time to do so. So let's start in this first relatively short block, Joseph, by setting the stage for the more in-depth conversations we're going to have. As I say, you've been tracking Latin America for a long time. You've served there. You have studied it. You have written about it. What is at the sort of 30,000-foot level? Well, first of all, the importance of this hemisphere to our own security interests?
Well, first of all, Frank, that's, I think, a good way to start this conversation, because I think most listeners will probably understand that Latin America, for many reasons, hasn't really essentially got the highest priority among the U.S. foreign policy or national security community here in the United States. And I think that, you know, there's several ways to look at that. One is there was obviously very major concerns in the Middle East, especially after September 11th. I actually think that President George W. Bush had actually an intention to do more robust engagement in Latin America. He had this program called the Free Trade Area of the Americas that he wanted to launch, and a bunch of other security initiatives in the Western Hemisphere. But 9/11 changed a lot of that, so he obviously never really focused on it. But then, you know, they had the pivot to Asia. There's different looks at big challenges that we're facing around the world. And the other part of that is, I think that many people that were either considered Latin American experts or they were, you know, policymakers in the region, they in some respects sold kind of a bad diagnostic of what was happening in the region. They said that Latin America was a zone of peace, that it's really just about trade, and that mostly that these threats to in Latin America are mostly endogenous to corruption and lack of rule of law, and that, you know, these big actors or these big, you know, movements, they don't mean a whole lot. And I'm referring to Hugo Chavez at the time, that they're more bark than bite. And what we learned over time is something that the Defense Department has looked at quite closely. It's called threat convergence, which means that these separate little threats that we don't look at necessarily as major national security concerns, like drug trafficking, organized crime, which are concerns, but maybe not at the level of some of the big battles we're fighting in the Middle East. they have been converging with terrorist networks. They've been converging with proliferation networks. And where you see that convergence, I think the greatest is in Latin America. So within that, I think today, you know, many years later, 2020, some of the biggest challenges we're facing throughout the world, whether it's the encroachment of China and Russia in this era of great power competition, or whether it's Iran's hegemonic plans in the Middle East and elsewhere, whether it's the movement of international terrorist networks, Islamist terrorist groups, or transnational organized crime, whatever you're looking at in terms of major threats, it's all in Latin America, and it's becoming stronger by the minute.
Well, that's a well said and very succinct description of the problem, both what's happening on the ground and why we are not perceiving it as the serious challenge that it is. And Joseph, I guess I would just ask, presumably those who have been, well, disinforming us, those experts, those diplomats, those policymakers, and some now no longer in office, have come to the same conclusion that you have, based on the facts, have they not? Is there now basically a consensus that Latin America is the front line of some of these struggles that, as you say, we are having, and we'll talk more about shortly, with Russia, with China, with Iran, with, you know, sort of Islamists, even North Korea, I think, is in the act. Is that now well understood by the policy community, would you say?
I think it's better understood, for sure. I think there's more attention being paid to it. I think this current administration, the Trump administration, has applied more resources, more personnel. He made a lot of this a priority for the administration. But I also think one of the reasons that this has become a priority isn't necessarily because the United States has engaged the region strategically. I think it's partially because the threat has come to us in the form of Venezuela. Venezuela has become a major concern globally because of the level of refugees, the humanitarian concerns, these threat networks that reside within Venezuela, and these big external state actors like Russia, Iran, China, Turkey, that have all entrenched themselves with the Maduro regime. So Venezuela, in many ways, I look at Venezuela almost like the biggest lesson learned from the failures of our foreign policy in the past. Like, what we didn't do to engage Latin America has essentially manifested itself in what is the crisis of Venezuela. I think we are paying more attention. I think there's more resources, there's more things being developed to be able to deal with these threats. But I wouldn't say so far as that there's a consensus. I think there's still obviously a lot of folks that don't look at it this way, particularly in Latin America. I think a lot of policymakers in Latin America still don't see all these threats. But that's changing, especially just in here in this last year in 2020. Last year in 2019, if you were to talk about China and Latin America, 95% of that conversation with policymakers in the region would have been about trade. It would have been about commerce, foreign investment. And now in 2020, at least there is a component of that conversation that's talking about potential more nefarious actions or hidden intentions or covert action, which we know China engages in. And China tends to shield its military ambitions with commercial activity. And so now that's becoming a point of conversation in Latin America. But again, it's not because we were proactive. It's because a major virus hit the world.
A Chinese Communist Party virus at that. Joseph, we have to take a short break. We're going to be right back with more about, Venezuela first, I think, and China right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are speaking with Joseph Heumeier, one of our country's preeminent experts, I believe, on Latin America and the vital national security interests that are at stake and what happens there. And Joseph, you set up very nicely the conversation about the country that obviously comes to the forefront. It's not the only problem we've got in the region, needless to say, or the only problem that the region itself has. But it is really a metastasizing cancer, this communist regime under Nicolas Maduro. Talk a little bit about why that is so, how it is that, well, for one thing, the arguably richest country in Latin America, has fallen on such hard times thanks to this Marxist takeover of that country, first under Hugo Chavez and now under Nicolas Maduro, and all that has flowed from it for the people of Venezuela and the region beyond.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. I think Venezuela is that, unfortunately, that really bad example of what's the worst case scenario, what can happen when you fail to pay attention to these threats and you don't take some of this stuff seriously. And so, as you said, Frank, Venezuela is not a product that, it's not a consequence that's happened overnight. It's not something that evolved within the last couple of years or a few years. It's something that's taken 21 years to really get to this situation. You're 100% right. This Venezuela wasn't always in this precarious situation. It is considered one of the wealthiest countries in Latin America in terms of natural resources. And you know, back in the 20th century, it had a, you know, it was a very developing country. It had a lot of boom in trade. Obviously, the oil-producing country, so it had engagements throughout the entire world. But then Hugo Chavez came to power, and so Hugo Chavez's mandate, which lasted 14 years, really destroyed the country's economy. Unfortunately, he never lived to see that destruction because the kind of straw that broke the camel's back in Venezuela was the plunging oil prices. But they already signed of the failing economy before that, going all the way back to 2009. But in 2014, when prices, you know, hit rock bottom with oil, you know, Venezuela just couldn't withstand it. And so the crisis in Venezuela, at least the economic crisis, really began in 2014. That manifests itself into a humanitarian crisis that began in 2017. And during that period, there was various moments where the opposition rose up and tried to take the country back, because the Maduro, who became the handpicked successor of Chavez, was essentially just, you know, decided to stay in power without any respect to the democratic norms. And so they tried time and again through uprisings, through military, to appeals to the military, but nothing worked. And then in 2019, the National Assembly, which is the only constitutional element left in Venezuela, the only legitimate democratic institution left in Venezuela, decided to take matters into their own hands and say that President Juan Guaido is the de facto legitimate president according to the Constitution, which is, by the way, Chavez's Constitution, the one that he rewrote back in the early 2000s. So this all leads into the situation where you have this impasse. You have about, I think in Venezuela kind of represents that divide in the world where you have about 60 countries or so in the world not recognize the Maduro regime. They say that's not a legitimate president. His government is not a legitimate government, and therefore they don't any kind of diplomatic or other engagement with Maduro, and they look at President Juan Guaido. But we have to also be honest, and there's probably about another 60 or 70 other countries that do recognize Maduro, and these aren't the countries that we would call Western countries or even democratic countries, but nonetheless, they're in the UN, and they have a voice, and they have a vote, and I'm talking about countries like Syria, I'm talking about countries like Libya, and obviously the bigger countries that are behind them, like Iran, Russia, China. So that's what we have today. It's left an impasse where essentially for more than a year, about a year and a half now, there's been strong efforts to find a way through President Juan Guaido and his interim government to essentially end the usurpation of Nicolas Maduro and move into free and fair elections. That hasn't had much success. And hasn't had much success principally for two reasons. And the first reason is there was a heavy dependence on the Venezuelan military. Most folks in the Guaido government, or I'd say most folks that were looking at Venezuela, had a kind of a notion, or maybe a premise that the center of gravity to be able to take away power from Nicolas Maduro was to flip the military, to get the military behind Juan Guaido. And if you're able to do that, then Maduro would fall. And the efforts to do that were unsuccessful. And I actually argued that I don't even think the military is that critical factor, because if we were to appreciate the military as an institution in Venezuela, and we would look at all the other institutions in the country, none of them work. I mean, another important institution in Venezuela is the oil institution. It's a largely oil-producing country. It's their major export, 90% of their exports. So if you look at PDVSA, which is their state-owned enterprise, if President Guaido were to take power tomorrow, and he would want to turn PDVSA into the kind of oil entity that they would need to be able to ramp it up their oil production, he wouldn't be able to do so. Why? Because it no longer works like an oil institution. It's involved in illicit activities like money laundering and everything else. So we can appreciate that about PDVSA. We should be able to appreciate that about the military. Just because they have uniforms and they have rifles does then make them combat effective or be able to be useful in a scenario where the opposition would need them. So I think that was a big strategic mistake. It also had tactical errors, and essentially it never worked. And that's one of the reasons we're here at this kind of impasse today.
So the impasse is, I guess you'd call it a Venezuelan standoff, not a Mexican one, but a standoff between Juan Guaido, who does have considerable external support, and we believe has support within the country as well, though it's very dangerous, of course, to express that support. And certainly, as you say, the institutions of the government have not rallied to his cause. Meanwhile, Maduro is holding on to power. He is increasingly able to sustain himself through a variety of extra legal means, as well as the involvement of foreign governments. And I wanted to just start with the role that you've seen these governments playing. Which ones are most important to the regime, and how would you characterize the benefit that accrues to them of helping to perpetuate this clearly failed government at the terrible cost to its people of literally extreme privation, in some cases even starvation?
Yeah, so I think this is another aspect within the crisis of Venezuela that was underestimated, was not just the role, but also the level of influence and control that these external state actors have over the Maduro regime. And let me use an analogy, if I may, Frank. I think this the best way to kind of look at Venezuela is to also compare it to Syria and the crisis and conflict that happened in the Middle East. And so if we take a lesson from Syria after 9 years of civil war since 2011, and we start to take, like, what's the main takeaway or one of the takeaways that we have from the Syria conflict? I think one of them is that the notion now that there's a weaker Bashar al-Assad, a weaker Assad regime, which has gotten weakened over time through U.S. actions, multilateral actions, but doesn't necessarily mean that that's an Assad regime that's going to be removed from power. That a weaker Assad regime is essentially an Assad regime that's going to be more dependent on external state actors. You know, in comes Iran, Hezbollah, Russia, Turkey, etc. That same lesson is applicable to Venezuela. The weakening of the Maduro regime, which I think is undoubtedly, anyone would say, is weaker. It has less access to resources, has less legitimacy, it has some levels of fracture within. But that weakness didn't manifest itself as the ability to remove Maduro from power. It just gave more impetus to the external actors that were supporting him all along. The first is Cuba. Cuba has been there the whole time. It's one of the most important partners to the Maduro regime. I think it's one of the most well-known. And when this crisis really started to hit with, at least here in the U.S., with U.S. Government attention, was in 2017, I think the first major premise was that this was a Cuban-occupied country, that the military was controlled by the Castro regime in Havana, and that the Cubans had basically penetrated, well, I don't even say penetrated is the right word, they essentially partnered with the regime and had high levels of ability to control immigration, information, you know, military armaments. And so I think that's still true to this day, very much a problem, particularly within the military intelligence, a network that's called the DGCIM in Spanish, the DGCIM, which this is a counterintelligence network, which is probably up there with one of the worst in the world in terms of repression and this violation of human rights. And the Cubans are the ones that really designed that. Second, I'd say, is the Russians. And that really surfaced more in 2018. And this was something I think was underestimated initially, because in 2017, a lot of people said the Russians were just peripherally involved, that they weren't going to get. I remember being in meetings in Washington, you know, private meetings with high-ranking officials, where folks had said, the Russians will never send military troops to help Maduro. That this is more just commercial for them. They want the oil, but they're not going to actually engage militarily. Well, in 2018, that proved to be wrong, because Russia had sent military folks to Venezuela. They've also sent mercenaries to Venezuela, and now they are essentially patrolling the border along Colombia. And the Russians have specific interests as well. And you know, where they were right is that they do have interest in the oil production in Venezuela. I think the estimates now, they control upwards of 90% of the oil exports to Venezuela. So they have become a major player on that front as well. Then come, I'd say, Iran. And this is one, I think, that I paid special attention to, and one that most people had ignored. And many people just discounted Iran completely, thought Iran was just a peripheral actor. And Iran really didn't have any capabilities to really help the Maduro regime or do anything necessarily, other than maybe some intelligence support. Well, 2020, we've seen that completely change. Iran essentially has an air bridge to Venezuela through these Mahan Air flights. They have a sea bridge through these oil tankers. And they now have a supermarket in Caracas, believe it or not, called Magasis. So they're selling Iranian product to the people of Venezuela. So Iran, we could get more into that, but Iran is, I think, probably one of the most important players in Venezuela. And then lastly is China. And China is one that I think really hasn't been discussed properly, right? The discussion on China and Venezuela right now is most encompassed around the notion that China really just wants to get paid back for their loans and their credit.
Joseph, we are going to talk about it properly here. We're going to have to do it on the other side of a short break, though. And when we come back, we will take stock on what you've already said and what you are about to tell us about China. That and much more with Joseph Heumeier, the author of an important book on the subject of the penetration of Latin America and the implications of having these dangerous foreign powers in, well, some people call it our backyard. I think of it as our front yard. That and much more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are speaking with Joseph Heumeier. He runs the Center for a Secure Free Society, which is an extremely valuable resource for the sorts of things we're talking about. Thanks to his leadership, it is one of the most important sources of information about what's happening on the ground in Latin America, particularly the hands of hostile foreign powers who are now deeply penetrated inside our hemisphere and are extending their networks for a variety of very ominous purposes. And we'll talk a little bit more about that with Joseph in the moments ahead. But Joseph, I wanted to specifically ask you to pick up where you left off before the break, which is you were going to give us a relatively deep dive on what China is up to there. It turns out it's not just about trying to get paid back for the loans that they have made to the first Chavez, I believe, and then Maduro regimes. Talk about the Chinese Communist Party's operations in Venezuela.
No, this has been something I think that has been lacking a little bit when we talk about these external actors in Venezuela. While the focus has been on the other actors, China, I think, is very much a major player. So above and beyond its economic activities, China wasn't necessarily naive. And when they were putting all this money into Venezuela in the past, they didn't think that, you know, Venezuela was a great market player and they were going to get a huge return on investment. I think China was buying access, and they were buying access both in terms of territory and access in terms of certainly certain domains within Venezuela. One of those is space. And I think that's something that we have to pay very close attention to as we're looking at China starting to get more into quantum communications. They have an ability to manage communications in Venezuela with its state-owned enterprises like ZTE that have a control mechanism that can easily be exported throughout the region. The other, I think, is satellite tracking. China has a satellite tracking facility in a military installation in Venezuela called Capitan Manuel Rios Air Base. It's in the center of the country. It's in a state called Guarico. And we don't really know a whole lot about that because it's completely covered by the Maduro regime. But it's very similar to the satellite tracking station that they have in Argentina, which has got some press coverage recently. And the only thing we know about those is that they're run by the PLA. So they're not run by Chinese commercial entities. They're run by the Chinese military. And by extension, looks to have more military ambitions rather than just exploring the deep side or exploring the other side of the moon or deep space exploration. So China, so this is just a little bit of a nugget of I think what China is really trying to accomplish with Venezuela, which is above and beyond just, you know, commercial trade or, you know, getting return on investment. And I think that's a part that we haven't focused on a lot when it comes to Beijing.
Let me just ask you about one other country you alluded to in one of the earlier comments you made, and that is Turkey. Is Recep Tayyip Erdogan also engaged in Venezuela at the moment?
Yeah, thanks, Frank. I actually forgot to mention Turkey. Yes, Turkey is very much interested in Venezuela, and Turkey's kind of one of those new actors. Like, these other actors have been along all throughout the Chavez regime. They've been strategic partners of the Bolivarian regime in Venezuela. Turkey, however, came out of nowhere. For me, it was relatively new. In 2018, Turkey essentially ratcheted up its trade with Venezuela from nil. For like 2017, they had nothing. In 2018, they ratcheted up to exporting, Venezuela exporting close to $900 million worth of gold, upwards about 23.6 tons of gold to Turkey. The thing about this was going to Turkey at a time when Venezuela was undergoing a huge scarcity of food. And so what essentially happened was Turkey got involved with Iran and some other elements, and they set up offshore accounts that were depositing some of these funds into the Caribbean that were paid to Mexican food distributors. And then some of these, this infamous military CLAP program, which is the food distribution program that the military and Maduro's military runs inside Venezuela, started bringing food. So ostensibly that sounds like a good thing, but what happens is they were overselling, they were overpricing the food to the Venezuelans, picking where they were going to give that support inside Venezuela, obviously more to regime supporters and not to opposition elements. And so they were politicizing the food distribution. What the Treasury looked at this, and they essentially denominated this as a gold for food scheme. Essentially, they were using a humanitarian assistance, but they were layering it with a criminal network. The people that were running this, one of them is now incarcerated in Cape Verde, hopefully waiting extradition to the U.S., a gentleman named Alex Saab. He built this network with Turkey, with Iran, with Russia, and with Venezuela, and he did it through, he layered it through a trade-based money laundering network, which is what he was running before that.
So Alex Saab is a mastermind of this sort of transnational criminal enterprise that is keeping the Maduro regime afloat. You mentioned that he's been incarcerated in Cape Verde Islands. What are the chances that he will be, in fact, extradited back to the United States and become, hopefully, a, well, gold mine, if I can use that expression, of information about what Maduro's up to and with whom?
So nothing is done till it's done, but I remain optimistic that he will be extradited. The Maduro regime tried many different tricks to be able to get him out of prison in Cape Verde. They introduced his diplomatic immunity because he apparently has a Venezuelan diplomatic passport, even though he's Colombian by birth. And then his lawyers tried many arguments in terms of habeas corpus and the act that they just thought it was a wrongful arrest and it wasn't done under normal procedures. So they tried many things that the Cape Verdean authorities didn't accept. However, because we don't have an extradition treaty with Cape Verde, it has to go through their judicial process first before he can be extradited. And it's going through that right now. I think we're at the point where it's really just waiting for a final decision by the magistrates, by the judges in Cape Verde. And once they make that decision, if it's favorable, then he'll be extradited shortly after. So I'm expecting that to happen. What I've been told, everything that I've been told from my sources is that the Cape Verdean authorities have been acting judicially on this. They haven't been being influenced by any corruption or any shenanigans by the regime or others. So I'm looking forward. And this is a major get for U.S. law enforcement, for just essentially the Venezuelan people, because Alex Saab is what I call a super facilitator. He's not just your normal front guy. He actually has a tremendous amount of knowledge of how these networks function. And in fact, he is somebody that moves multiple networks in different countries and in different continents. And he was very close to Erdogan in Turkey and to the Ayatollahs in Iran. After he did the successfully did the gold for food scheme with Turkey, what he was doing this year in 2020 was he was building a gold for gas scheme with Iran. This is what has to do with the tankers that were coming down. So he's a major player, and the fact that we could get him off the, you know, a proverbial battlefield is a very good thing. So this is kudos to the DOJ and others that have been involved in this case.
Please keep us surprised of what's happening as this fellow Alex Saab strikes me as a possibly game-changing figure in terms of both being able to expose the networks that he's put into place and the larger modus operandi. But let me come back to the question that really struck me in what you said earlier. The fact that there are military forces, not just Cuban forces, which have been there for some time and have been forming sort of a Praetorian guard, as you've told us in previous visits, for Maduro, really keeping him in power. They've penetrated and are assuring, I guess, the loyalty of the Venezuelan military. And we talked about how critical their being out of the play here has been for the efforts of the opposition to free the country of Maduro. But when you said Russian troops are on the ground in Venezuela, both in connection with their air defense systems, they've sold the Venezuelan government, but also now patrolling the border with Colombia. This is really, you know, a ratcheting up of the fact that you know, the Monroe Doctrine is in shreds as a premise, a central tenet of, you know, U.S. government policy for many, many years, that we would not accept the presence or intervention of foreign governments into our hemisphere. But again, I ask the question, Joseph, you're interacting with policymakers in the Trump administration. Are they seeing the presence of these sorts of foreign military personnel as an impetus for a much more assertive American policy, or are they, as have their predecessors been, so distracted by other things that perhaps rhetorically there's a heightened level of interest, as there should be, but that it's not being sort of pursued with the vigor that it needs to be on the ground and with action?
Yeah, so I think Russia has obviously couched it, the relationship with Venezuela, within two major sectors. One is energy within the oil exports. And as I mentioned before, one of their major state-owned enterprises, Rosneft, was on the ground in Venezuela, owning the concessions of some of their major oil deposits. That has changed because of the sanctions. So they essentially withdrew Rosneft and they put some other Russian, more directly Russian-owned company there, but it really hasn't been evolved the same way. But the other major sector that they've been involved in is foreign military sales. So, Butin, I think about 2002, if I remember right, to about 2012 or 13, about a period of about a decade there under Hugo Chavez, Russia sold upwards of $11 billion of Russian military armament to Venezuela. It's their largest client in Latin America. And because of that, there was a series of technicians that would come on and off to Venezuela to be able to do the maintenance on these equipments. This includes the S-300 air defense system. So what happened is through the time, and you know, as you get closer to the crisis, they swapped out these Russian technicians. And what Russia said, what Putin had said, was these technicians were being swapped out for defense export, defense contractors, individuals that were going to come in that had more specialty and expertise. But among those defense contractors, among these folks that were coming in, some belonged to this mercenary group called the Wagner Group. Now, I'm no expert on the Wagner Group, but from what I've been told by folks that follow them, their activities in Ukraine, their activities in Syria, their activities in Africa, was the Wagner Group is essentially a paramilitary network that Russia uses with the special operations forces.
Joseph, we have to pause for one last break. When we come back, I want to finish that thought, of course, but also talk with you a little bit about what Maduro's regime may be doing here in the United States as well, which makes this not just an abstract problem for our security, but a present danger. That and much more with Joseph Humeyer of the Center for a Secure, Free Society, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to this fourth and final installment of this hour-long conversation with one of our great resources on Latin America. He is Joseph Humeyer. He has been in the field, in the region, first as a Marine, and since then, among other roles, as the executive director of the Center for a Secure Free Society. To his credit, Joseph has put together one of the really seminal works on this problem of foreign penetration of our hemisphere, namely a book entitled Iran's Strategic Penetration of Latin America. Joseph, just finish the thought, if you would, about this Wagner Group and the Little Green Men, I think they've been called in various theaters where they've been operating. They really are just extensions, although they may have some deniability by the Russian government, but really just an extension of Putin's military operations, are they not? And what is the Trump administration doing to reckon with their presence and activities in the region?
No, yeah, you're right, Frank. This has kind of been looked at in terms of maybe perhaps an extension of the Russian special operations. And in Venezuela specifically, what they've been involved in is looking at the radar technology. And they've been helping the Maduro regime improve its surveillance systems and its ability to control different networks that are operating within the country, including opposition networks. But what they also believe to be other like Colombians or whoever else they think that is basically working against the regime. The thing is, I think that this, I don't have this, I couldn't confirm this, but I think that we have to look at this within the nexus of what it could potentially be doing with the formal Russian presence that's in Venezuela with the either the energy or with their military systems. Last year in March of 2019, I remember that there was a major general that came to Venezuela. His name was General Vasily Tuchnisharov. If I'm butchering his name, I apologize. But essentially, he's one of the ground force commanders of the Russian Federation. And he met and he had like an extensive meeting with the regime. And this is right before the time where these Wagner Group folks started coming into the country. So we don't really know, as most cases, what they're exactly doing. But I can guarantee you it's more than just their energy or their military systems that they're monitoring, because they have other groups doing that. I think it has more to do with setting up a kind of a protection system that allows them to enhance their ability to harden the regime.
Well, and to the extent that the USG is seized with this problem, I think it needs to redouble its efforts. And if it's not seized with it, it better get on the stick. Let me turn to the other piece of this that is also worrying, and that is we've seen photographs of leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement expressing solidarity with, and in one case at least, you know, kind of high-fiving with Nicolas Maduro himself in Venezuela. There is a piece that you tweeted out by David Grantham at Breitbart recently that caught my eye, and it's basically referring to the extent to which we are seeing not only the playbook of how revolutionaries like Chavez, you know, gained power in Latin America, but we may be seeing, in fact, even more direct involvement of the Venezuelan government in some of the rioting and mayhem that's been taking place here, much of it under the cover of communists like Maduro, whether they're Antifa or Black Lives Matter. What light can you shed on those connections for us, Joseph Humar?
Yeah, so the article that was in Breitbart was written by one of our senior fellows. His name is David Grant. And what he essentially was doing with the article was he was comparing what we've seen recently in the last few months with these massive protests, and not just the protests, but the looting, riots, and everything, the violence that is extenuated from the protests here in the United States. And he's correlated that with protests that happened last year in Latin America, particularly in South America. So very quickly, let me sum up for those that don't know what happened last year in South America. There was major rioting and looting and violence and destruction in particularly three countries, in Ecuador, Chile, and Colombia, between September and December of last year. This brought many of those governments to their knees. The Piñera government in Chile is still negotiating based off that violent episode. The Duque government got affected. The Lenin Moreno government in Ecuador had to move its capital. It had to move its administration from the capital city in Quito to Guayaquil. So this was seriously intense. And what we saw was that essentially the use of cyber networks that would allow one grievance in one country, such as Ecuador, over, I think it was fuel subsidies, to extend itself to another country, which has a completely separate grievance, which was public transportation prices in Chile. You know, these were legitimate grievances that, you know, there were people protest at any given time, but they were able to connect them through cyber networks, so they exacerbated the outcry. And that's why the authorities didn't expect the level of volume that would have come out onto the streets when it actually had.
And do you have any evidence that those cyber operations are foreign engineered or supported, at least?
Yes. So the Chileans, particularly, and the Colombians, both detected Cuban and Maduro regime cyber, what they call critical nodes, within the cyber networks that were attaching to these protests, but also Russians. And I think there, in one case, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's mentioned in the article, where there was a series of amount of tweets that happened in a period of time. And I think somewhere upwards around 80% of those tweets were foreign. They didn't come from the specific country. Like, I think it was Chile. They didn't come from Chile. They were coming from Spain, or they were coming from Russia, but through these networks.
They're being orchestrated. this so-called Bolivarian hurricane, as it's called by its perpetrators, is at work here as well?
So I believe it is. I haven't seen conclusive evidence on this, but we have seen some symbolism, meaning that in the George Floyd protests in Miami and Minneapolis and Washington, D.C., Texas, and elsewhere, you've seen socialist iconography, like you've seen the flags of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, an indigenous movement in Chile called the Mapuches, which was a big symbol in the Chile protests. You've seen that in Minneapolis. You've seen Chavista symbols in some of these protests, which has nothing to do with the original grievance of discrimination within the police or racial issues. This is Latin American socialism, essentially. But I think you see it because these networks blend together. And they blend together in ways I think some of the people don't even realize. People that are involved in these protests don't even realize, because they think it's, they're just going out and, practicing their constitutional amendment. But in reality is there's movements that have subverted these protests and that are using them for much bigger causes. And so what we talked about when we talk about the playbook is, in Latin America, we've seen this, because this has already evolved in Latin America. You start with a legitimate grievance, you take that grievance, and then you try to exacerbate it with all kinds of other issues, and then you attempt to rewrite history. So what we're seeing right now with the changing of names, of taking down a monument, changing the names of military bases, we saw that in Venezuela. That already happened. He completely rewrote the Venezuelan history book, rewrote the Constitution, and took away the collective memory of and the identity of what it was to be a Venezuelan, which is what they're paying for today. And so I think that's the concern, is that this is just one step that we're seeing here that we not thought we would never really see, of a much larger effort globally to essentially break down individual liberties and constitutional freedoms.
Yeah, and I guess the bottom line here, Joseph, is that they have a shared purpose. These Marxists, whether they're of the Chinese stripe or the Russian stripe or the folks who align with them, who are of the Islamist stripe, they may have differences in terms of the end state they seek, but they all have in common a desire to have the United States removed as an obstacle to their ambitions and destroy it, for that matter. That certainly seems to be the object of the revolutionaries who are in our streets right now. And to the extent that you're able to connect some dots here between what Maduro is up to, what his backers are helping him do, cyber or other kinds of support, financial or simply logistical, to those who are in this country now, in our streets, not just, tearing down statues and trying to burn federal courthouses, but really seeking the overthrow of the United States government, which I'm satisfied is exactly what the Black Lives Matter organizers, not all the protesters, but the organizers, the Freedom Road Socialist Organization and the Liberation Road that are tied to these communist parties overseas and enabling this kind of insurrection here are all about. And it just brings home the central point of your work at the Center for a Secure Free Society and that of ours at the Center for Security Policy and purpose of this show, which is to call the American people's attention to why Latin America and other hotspots in the world matter to our vital interests and security. Joseph Humeyer, we thank you for the work you do in that regard and so many others, and for your visits with us. Come back to us again soon, if you will. Hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.